I'm Brian Foster, and this is the Grindhouse Institute. On each episode of this podcast, Jeremy Floyd and I program a triple feature movie night. Each of the movies share common themes, and we discuss them here. We're happy you could join us for today's block we call Horror Anthology 301. Today, we're focused on our annual jaunt through the world of vignetted horror with a look at some more horror anthology films, my favorite. And to usher in our amazing block of cinema, our old friend, the Ghoul of the Grindhouse.
Hello, kiddies. It's me, the Ghoul of the Grindhouse, here to treat you to another trio of terrorific, tantalizing talkies. Multiple manuscripts from the master of the macabre, Edgar Allan Poe, are adapted to the big scream in this petrifying picture about a bad dad, a jealous juice head, and a maniacal mesmerist. Written by Richard Matheson and starring Vincent Slice, Peter Gorey, and Basil Rathbone. This is Roger Gorman's Tales of Terror from 1962. A boy on a bike named Billy covets a new comic from the creep who has a cartload of copies of the current Chronicle. Billy ravenously rifles through and reads the rags in a rapture. In it, there are stories of special stones, sawed-off shotguns and scalpings, swimming, seclusion, and slicks of slime, sinners, sideswipes, and a stubborn specter with a sign. George Slay Romero adapts Cleveland King's stories, and George Kennedy, Gorothy L'Amour, and Tom Fright star in 1987's Creepshow 2. A gullible group of gangsters meet with a maniacal mortician to salvage a shipment of skag, but first they have to humor the hermit and hear his hearsay histories of horror. Careening from one casket to the next, the Bandito boys begin to wonder what might be waiting for them at the terminus of these terrifying tales. Scarence Williams III, Rosalind Slash, David Allen Fear, and an eerie ensemble star in Disgusty Cundiff's Tales from the Hood from 1995. Thank you for listening to the Grindhouse Institute. Please enjoy.
This is the beat of a human heart. Sit very still and listen. Is your heart beating in this same rhythm? You are experiencing the heartbeat of a dying man, and it is with death and dying that we concern ourselves. What happens at the point of death? What happens afterwards?
Hey man, fuck this man.
I ain't with this shit.
Y'all can have this. What? I just ain't into this dead people shit, all right?
Shit, man, that place does look evil as hell.
Y'all need to shut the fuck up, all right? We doing this shit because this here's business, man. Besides, dead people ain't who y'all need to be worried about anyway. Lil Mo, who the fuck y'all need to be worried about? Now, the sooner we get the shit, the sooner we raise up out this motherfucker, man.
All right, welcome back to the Grindhouse Institute. I am Brian Foster, and with me as always is Jeremy Floyd. Hello, and how are you?
Well, before we get started, I'd like to say thanks for the ride, lady.
Man, my cousin Ricky and I used to run around the house going, thanks for the ride, lady. We love that one.
Classic.
Today's, we are going to be back to class today, right? We're heading back to class. Class is in session.
There goes the bell right there.
And if we're doing this podcast thing correctly, you most likely heard from the Ghoul of the Grindhouse giving his pun-filled intro to all these all these films.
If we have time to write that one. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we got to get that one going again. And then, so we're going to be talking anthology horror again. So this is Anthology Horror 301. And today's show, we're going to be featuring Tales of Terror from 1962, Creepshow 2 from 1987, and Tales from the Hood from 1995. Another good block of anthology films, I'd say.
Yeah, well, I was actually, so we kind of, we do this this show every year, right? This is kind of one of our longer running gags here.
Love it.
And it's always a fun one. And, you know, I think in previous years we had compiled just a bunch of stuff that we wanted to do, and we're like, okay, we've been talking about Tales from the Hood, we got to put that on there. I feel like more than one person's brought up Creepshow 2, so it was like, okay, let's put that. And then Tale of Terror was actually just a last minute addition. I had never seen it, and I frankly had never heard of it. I am aware of the Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe adaptations. Most of those had, of course, Vincent Price in them.
That was like his 60s filmmaking.
Yeah. And they did like...
tons.
Yeah, 6, 7, 8 of these movies. They did a ton of them.
That guy was directing like 5 movies a year.
Well, I mean, Roger Corman? No, he was directing like 200 movies a year. Like
right, sorry, 500, yeah.
Yeah, you've got a couple zeros there. But he... So one of the, you know, Poe Corman movies... was also an anthology movie. And I was like, oh, well, we got to do that. And I think part of this kind of came up because one of our biggest Twitter fans, anyway, shout out to Amy Laura Hall for at least putting us in the direction of, you know, Corman and Poe.
I can't believe we have a listener. Shout out to our listener.
Oh, a listener, yes.
This is so exciting to me, man. And like, interaction happening, and I love it. So thank you very much for the suggestion, because I really enjoyed this one. I mean, we'll get into it more, but I'm really glad we got to add this one based on that recommendation.
Yeah. Well, and no wonder our podcast gets one play every week.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Better than no plays.
Yeah. No, but it was great. And I think, you know, she talked about, I think, how one of the other movies, maybe it was The Raven or maybe The Mask of the Red Death, one of those, you know, Corman Poe adaptations, you know, scared the pants off her when she was a kid. I don't know if she saw this one, but if so, maybe, or if not, maybe she will after this. But And if so, maybe it'll be bringing back some terrifying memories.
I would say this one was pretty terrifying. There's definitely some moments in there. And with the clearly low budget that Corman had to work with, he still did quite a great job.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, reusing the set from, 400 other movies that they did in sort of the Gothic era.
Which one? That one exterior?
Well, I just meant some of the interior sets. Oh, yeah. Where it's like, you know, these like abandoned, you know, sort of dusty castles that these guys were in. Yeah. I mean, and then the very first one in particular.
Morella.
You know, because we had kind of cobbled this one together kind of randomly, it was just like, well, what's the connection? Oh, they're just all horror anthology films. I kind of just expected it to just be kind of all over the place. But this block kind of came together a little better than I thought, which is that, like, you know, Tales of Terror was this sort of classic gothic horror, and Creepshow 2 was sort of more modern, everyday, you know, that Stephen King vibe of just like, you know, it could be happening to anyone vibe. And Tales from the Hood is both. It's crazy. It's
that's
like,
great. Yeah, exactly.
You know, like especially like when we get to it, the Rosalind Cash, you know, mental asylum up there. It looks very Arkham. Is very gothic. Yeah. Is very, you know, Edgar Allan Poe or maybe Lovecraft.
Right.
But you know, the mortuary, all that stuff. It's like they really blended it together, and I think, you know, it turns out these movies came together a little better than I thought.
It seems to happen with us, right? Like we're just kind of throwing the shit together, and all of a sudden it works.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah, the movie gods are smiling on us. And then also, I guess one other just, you know, connection for the whole thing maybe is the Thanks for the Ride, Lady Hitchhiker was also in Tales from the Hood. You know, he was, I always think of him as George Costanza's boss at the Yankees or whatever, who he's like screws over for not, you know, letting him sign the card or whatever. Screwed me again, Costanza.
Well, you screwed me again, Costanza. How am I supposed to sign the card now, huh? It's already under glass.
But it's like, you know, he was also in Tales from the Hood. He was in the sort of the first tale from Tales in the Hood.
Right.
He was the sort of activist who gets murdered by the cops.
Yeah, I thought his work in Creepshow 2 wasn't half as good as the stuff he did in Seinfeld. If that's the case. I didn't even know until you said that was the same person, because I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's really funny. Man, that episode still scares the pants out of me, but we'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Let's do Tales of Terror. Let's talk Poe. Yeah. Let's talk Corman. Poeman, I guess. We'll do the combination of Corman and Poe together. Edgar Allan Corman.
Yeah, there you go. Wait a minute. Is there an echo in here?
I wanted to bring up one thing. I'll get this out of the way because I really enjoyed this film. However, one disappointment I had was that there was no spine and there was nothing interconnecting everything together. Not even a, you know, person sitting around a fire telling a story or something simple like that. We were just missing that one piece of this movie.
What was it? I mean, was there anything? Was it just, it was just a title card and kind of a...
And it was like a different
underwater effect.
It was different title card every time that kind of matched what the next sequence was going to be. But it really was just three short films put together. But there was nothing wrong with that. It's just it would have been really interesting to see some sort of through line. You know, I think that that's what really excites me about anthology. You know?
Well, and that's what usually the strongest one of the bunch that we do. You know, usually has that. As the like binder, you know, it's like,
yeah,
I think last time around it was, you know, the original sort of 70s Tales from the Crypt. And then before that,
British, that one was great.
Yeah.
What was interesting about that one is that you actually got to meet everybody as a group. And then individually you got each of their tales. I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, this one, I don't think it needed it. So to speak, it's just that's one thing that I always really hang on to with anthology films.
No, for sure, because then it just, you know, otherwise, I don't know, it's just some random short films.
Right, yeah.
And in this case, I mean, I guess, what, all of them have Vincent Price in it.
Right, in very different character roles, yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking, is the rest of the cast the same? No.
Peter Lorre only shows up
in
once.
One of them, but yeah.
But, I mean, let's start with the first one, Morella. This was Vincent Price at his creepiest, I'd say, of the three. You know, he was abusive father, blamed his daughter for the death
negligent.
Yeah, blamed his daughter for the death of his wife, the titular Morella. And then you find out that he's just Ed Geening and Norman Batesing this woman inside the castle, right? Just holding on to the corpse as it slowly deteriorates in bed. Creepy as hell.
Yeah.
But I like this one. I always like Vincent Price. I think the second he walks on screen, you're in for a good horror jaunt. This one was good because it had kind of a slow burn, but I thought the payoff was great. And I don't mean burn in a pun either.
Yeah.
but definitely
no
the
pun intended.
The ending
or was it?
It was definitely intended. It mostly is.
Kiddies, you're just in time for your driving lesson. Today, we'll be learning about scarrel parking and the right way to look behind when hacking up.
But the payoff is great at the end. You know, we get a body swap tale of mother-daughter, and then all of a sudden the place is ablaze, if you will.
Well, I feel like I missed a page around that time where it's like, okay, so... The whole idea is Vincent Price has his, you know, dead wife, you know, decades long dead wife, her corpse sitting up in a bedroom somewhere.
Standard.
Kind of like, you know, yeah, exactly. kind of a Norman Bates situation.
Yeah.
With his mother. But the mother wanted the revenge against the daughter because the mom went to a party and died, or she gave birth during childbirth or died during childbirth or something.
Sounds like we both missed a couple pages there, if that's where we're heading.
Because she went, she's like, you know, she took over the body of her daughter and then, like, you know, did the body swap horror and then, you know, it was like killing Vincent Price over it. And then, you know, we get the sort of reveal that maybe it was all in his head because it was his daughter's corpse on top of him. When it was all burning down?
I don't know. Maybe I didn't get that. But what my reading was that...
Did we watch the same movie?
Yeah. So Vincent Price blamed Lenora for Morella's death.
Mm-hmm.
Morella or Lenora was coming back from Boston to be with her father because she had a terminal illness. And I think she admitted that to him. So then all of a sudden they started actually having a bit of a relationship. And then Lenora finds her mom... decomposing in the bedroom, which is definitely not, you know, the best thing to see or find. But then, Morella just kind of rises from the dead. And then I think she switches places with her daughter, right? At one point, and Like, she's possessed by the...
Right, yeah. And it's because, like, what she was, like, she wanted revenge.
Kind of foggy there, huh?
Yeah.
It's like, okay. Who cares? There's a big fire at the end, and then the corpse is smiling because of it. The classic Tales from the Crypt ending, yeah, where the corpse is smiling.
You understand nothing. She was so young. So alive. To die just a few months after giving birth to you. She couldn't accept it.
I liked all these, but I think my favorite here was the third one, which we'll get to, but I think my favorite character in this was the Peter Lorre character in The Black Cat. So yeah. We've got Morello, like... The Black Cat is the second segment here, uh-huh. Which is just an alcoholic's tale of horror, kind of. Like,
right.
It's really interesting how he is an absolute drunk, so he's so much of a drunk that he puts himself into a wine tasting contest with, I'd say, the dandiest of Vincent Price of characters in this one, yes. Fortunato Lucchesi, which is right. His name. But man, those two together on screen were really, really interesting, playing off one another.
Oh, absolutely. And I love, so, you know, Peter Lorre is this, hapless drunk or whatever. He's spending every single last penny he has to drink wine or whatever, and you know he does all these hilarious things. He just, like, you know, bumps into a guy in the middle of the street and he's like, why don't you watch where I'm going and whatever. But it's like, you know, and then they have this sort of epic drinking contest, and he gets into it basically just to get free drinks, because, like, you know, he challenges the snootiest guy he could find.
But he was good at it.
To a drink-off. And, you know, he's like an idiot savant. He's just, like, naturally good at it.
Naturally, like, good at finding out or knowing what wine he's drinking.
Vincent Price is like... doing all the, like, you know...
The little cup he had that was, like, around his neck. I yeah, love that. Exactly.
Can't remember what that's called, but he had that thing. And, like, it was very sort of Amadeus and Salieri. It was like, you know, one's a buffoon and, you know, does it better. And, like, you know, one's trying really, really hard. Enough. Yeah.
And my name is Fortunato Lucchesi, at your service.
Montresor herringbone. What are we waiting for? Bring on the wine.
And then, you know, Vincent Price comes in to steal Peter Lorre's wife.
Right, exactly. So Peter Lorre rightly suspects that his wife is having an affair with the wine-tasting sommelier of Vincent Price in this one. So, you know, like anyone would, if they found that out, he killed them and then bricked them into the walls of their house, of his house.
Yeah. It was very, it's something to tide you over.
Yeah. And I mean, if you know this story pretty well, I think this also touches on some of the Telltale Heart too, right?
Well, I was going to say, actually, Cascoli Amontillado, right? I mean, isn't it they seal him up in the wall just like in that story?
Yeah, but
like,
I thought
he invites his friend over for the slightest of, slights, and then, you know, walls him up after tempting him with wine. I don't know. Yeah, I think they kind of put a bunch of stuff together. Oh, speaking of that, the writer on all three of these adaptations was Richard Matheson.
Yeah, I saw that. That's great.
And maybe that's another connection. We got...
Yeah, see?
An Omega Man connection. We got Rosalind Cash in right. Tales of the Hood and Richard Matheson, Tales of Terror.
Now cut to Charlie and Always Sunny with all the pins and needles on with all the ribbons.
Take a look at this. Jesus Christ, Charlie. That right there is the mail. Now let's talk about the mail. Can we talk about the mail, please, Mac? I'm dying to talk about the mail for you all day, okay? Pepe Sylvia, this name keeps coming up over and over again. Every day, Pepe's mail's getting sent back to me. Pepe Sylvia, Pepe Sylvia. I look in the mail. Well, this whole box is Pepe Sylvia. So I say to myself, I gotta find this guy. I gotta go up to his office. I gotta put his mail in the guy's goddamn hands. Otherwise, he's never gonna get it. It's gonna keep coming back down here. So I go up to Pepe's office, and what do I find out, Mac? What do I find out? There is no Pepe Sylvia.
The crux of this one is, and it's called The Black Cat, is that Peter Lorre hates this cat that his wife owns. And so I believe he killed the cat too, or thought he killed the cat, by sealing it into the wall as well.
Now, he seemed, I feel like he seemed surprised when he found the cat in there.
Oh, okay. So maybe I was confused on that too.
Yeah.
But
well, I guess I could have missed another note there. But, like, I feel like what it was is that, you know, he didn't know what happened to the cat, but whatever, he doesn't care because he hated the cat. But and then it gives him away because, yeah, kind of Telltale Heart style.
Right.
when the cops come snooping around, you know.
But he wasn't just being tempted by the cat either. He was being tempted by the two, the couple, or his wife and Vincent Price. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always thought that this story was interesting from a storytelling perspective, because this could be all in his head. And I think that that's really where the horror is, that he's being haunted and by the guilt of killing these two people, and he can just keep hearing them.
Well, that's a good point, because it's a very, very gothic idea. And shows up all the time. I mean, when we had Eileen Jones on to talk about gothic horror,
The Innocents,
every single one of those, you know, The Shining, The Innocents, The Haunting, they all had that sort of protagonist who may, you know, these horrors may or may not be happening. They may have just been in their head, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And this one does it really well. Tales from the Hood also does this really well, of like, you know, are these things happening, or are they sort of, you know, manifestations of, you know, their guilt and like their psychosis of the mind rejecting the sort of like violence and things that they had committed, you know?
I think that that's really interesting subject matter, and it still makes for good modern storytelling, even though this was 1960, but still pretty modern, you know, versus when Edgar Allan Poe originally wrote this, obviously. I thought that was a really good one. And I forgot to mention that I believe after every one of these segments too, they gave a quote from Poe. And this one was, I had walled the black monster up within the tomb. And so that's kind of like the giveaway that he actually did put the cat in there, or the cat, he found the cat in there. The third one here, The Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar. This one's my favorite. And I have a reason that this one's my favorite. So Two Evil Eyes is a collab project between George Romero and Dario Argento, and they both adapted two Poe tales as well. They did The Black Cat, and they did The Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar. When I watched this movie, I was like, shit, did they just kind of remake this movie in a way without the first tale, Morella? However, in this one, in The Black Cat, the one that Argento directs, Harvey Keitel plays the Peter Lorre character, I believe. And he's, I think he's a photographer. I don't remember exactly the idea around it or the details, but he does the same exact thing. He walls people up bricks them up into the wall, and finds when he gets in there and he can actually see what's behind the wall, this cat has completely like eaten away all of the dead bodies. it's like turned this version of it like to 11,
you
know,
just
like
cranked it's just it up. Yeah.
Disgusting. Yeah. But then The Fact in the Case of M. Valdemar, Romero directed that one. And it's very close. You know, obviously it's more of a modern version of that. It was done in the 80s. But it's the same kind of thing. A man who is so obsessed with his psychiatrist or hypnotherapist, he thinks that this guy has solved all his problems and made all his pains go away. And he kind of puts all of his faith in this one guy who ends up hypnotizing him as he's dying, and then he's trapped. That's scary, right? Like,
no, exactly. Well, he's like, what's the worst thing that can happen? I'm going to be dead anyway, you know? It's like, well, because the conceit is like the hypnotist is like, I'm going to hypnotize him right before he dies so we can talk to the other side real quick before the, you know,
just for a second.
Expires or whatever.
Not,
yeah.
Not for
but,
2 months.
But it turns out that, like, you know, he was able to keep him in this suspended state, hanging between life and death. And indefinitely, and what he was trying to do was, I don't know what, getting this rich guy to sign over all his assets or whatever to the hypnotist.
Now, talk about just desserts, right? The hypnotherapist gets haunted from his own doing in this one, and I love that so much.
Yeah.
But really great zombie type effects when Vincent Price wakes up, right? Yeah. His zombie wakes up,
zombie, right?
And he melts. And they keep doing this strange, like, watery dissolve, and every dissolve they had, his face was melting a little bit more. I thought it was effective.
That effect kind of reminds me of when one of the four cops gets, like, melted into the mural in Tales from the Hood. And like, they do a quick, like, dissolve of him, like, his face, like, melting off, and, like, you know, he, like, melts.
I love that.
Like, you know, looks like Pizza the Hut there for a second, and then, you know, it turns into the...
Lone into the Star. Page and his sidekick puke.
Barf. Not in here, you're not. This is a Mercedes.
Barf. you. Whatever. Where's my money?
So what do you think of this one?
I liked it. I think, you know, pacing wise, it you know, it's definitely the slowest of the bunch.
Sure.
The and yeah, not having a binder kind of like or a spine taking us through it definitely felt weaker in that sense. You know, the Black Cat, I really enjoyed. Yeah, Facts of actually all three of them. There was a lot of good stuff in it. I feel like most of them were just sort of uneven, though. It was like, you know, like maybe that there'd be if each one's, you know, 22 minutes long or something, you know, there'd be, you know, 18 minutes of good stuff and like so a little bit of chaff in there. We had, like, you know,
right. Yeah.
It didn't, you know, trim the fat. But then again, maybe the movie would just been would have been, you know, for 55 minutes. There.
Exactly. Yeah. 1 hour for three of them. And I am wondering, I mean, I didn't look too much into the history of this. I'm wondering if they were filming those as different films or if like the intention was to film them all together and put them together.
Oh, man. I guess Corman was notorious for doing that. It was like, you know, just like, well, we started one project or whatever and, you know, lost the location. We did that. Fine. We'll cut it into this movie. You know, it's like that kind of thing.
That so. Dude was born to make movies, huh?
I mean, he has made, I mean, so first of all, I mean, as of this recording, he's still alive and he's nearly 100 years old and he made, I mean, you know.
And he's still sharp. I don't know if you've seen him in interviews. Yeah, he's still like sharp as a tack.
Right, right. And you know, he's, I don't know what, made 1,000 movies. I mean, he's made so many movies. It's insane. I mean, him directing these movies was one thing, and that was,
right.
You know, he directed maybe, 200 movies, but he, you know, somehow, you know, he produced somewhere in the neighborhood. I mean, like, what, I don't know, 800 movies, 1,000 movies. I mean, it's
well,
so much.
If you watch anything from the 80s, you'll see the New World logo
come
up every single time almost.
Right.
So you're,
I mean,
you're just like,
pfft. It's either Vamp or Life Force. One of those was also a New World.
Life Force, I believe.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Producer, 515 credits. Director, only 56 credits.
Ooh, falling short.
515 credits. And, you know, there's a lot in there that's good, too. I mean, there's a lot of crap, you know, like I don't think he really had like a care in the world. He was just, we just kept wanting to make movies. I mean, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had this like sort of like practical version of film school that he ran, which is that like, okay, he'll get these ambitious film students, you know, as
paying
long
nothing.
As they hit X, Y, and Z and could turn in a movie on time and on budget within X amount of days or whatever. It's like they could sort of do whatever they want. You know, it's like, but the, you know, the second the monster died or whatever it was, that is the end of the movie. And like, you know, he had these sort of like rules where it, but as long as you hit that, you can kind of do whatever you want. And a ton of people came through there. I mean, tons and tons of people.
You know, oh, yeah.
James Cameron. Yeah. You know, Martin Scorsese got his first sort of like...
Wasn't that Boxcar Bertha?
Boxcar Bertha. I mean, it technically wasn't his first feature film.
Right.
But he did, you know, kind of movie on the weekends with his friends. And one of those friends happened to be Harvey Keitel. but, you know, the first sort of like movie with like a crew he did was for Roger Corman. And I mean, you know...
And Joe Dante was part of
Joe
that
Dante,
crew.
For sure. Peter Bogdanovich. I mean, like,
wow,
you know, tons and tons of people.
Legends, you know, yeah. He was crafting legends.
Yeah, exactly.
Shaping them.
I mean, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, that was a big mm-hmm. one. You know, Jonathan Demme.
Was Lucas part of that? George Lucas? Oh, Ron Howard. Ron Howard was part of that group.
Ron Howard. I mean, you know, he definitely did his first, Ron Howard directed his first movie
mm-hmm.
For Roger. You know, because he was obviously a child actor and whatever, but like, you know, changing lanes or whatever, he was able to do that,
and that's where his career kind of stayed for the
yeah
till today. Yeah,
exactly.
Grand Theft Auto, directed by and starring Ron Howard.
But I mean, these low budget movies made money, right? I mean, like, that was part of his genius as well, right?
Yeah.
They were he was a good marketer too, right? I mean, there's a lot around that.
I believe he had something like a perfect like distribution deal or something that's like already set up where it was. He would be able to pre-sell everything with drive-ins or something like that. And so he knew he would already have, be in the black as long as...
Have revenue or income.
The budget stayed at a certain level. And so, yeah, I mean, you could just kind of do whatever you wanted and they would still have made money, you know?
And man, he had that down to
science. You didn't have to, like, market them or whatever. All that kind of stuff that, like, you know, people run into today, you know, even in the indie world or whatever.
Right.
Oh, God. One thing we forgot to bring up was like how, you know, so they kept recycling, I'm sure, costumes and whatever between all of these different stories in Tales of Terror. But the one thing they 100% recycled in every single one of them was the candlestick holder with the giant Twizzler candles in them.
I didn't notice that. Twizzler candles.
They looked like candy. It's like it was like a Willy Wonka candle. It was nuts.
What do you do? You light this? No, you eat it. Yeah.
They're Venus flytraps. Giant Venus flytraps. They eat meat!
Well, shall we move right along?
Let's jump on our raft and head to Creepshow 2. How about that?
Oh, Creepshow 2. There's another New World picture.
Right. That must have been what it was that was fresh in my mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about it. Let's start with the fact that this is a sequel to probably my number one. It is probably the best anthology film ever made, I'd say. Horror anthology film is Creepshow, in my opinion. You know, people can argue that all day, but I mean, it's pretty much perfect. It's so fun. It's got everything going for it. This one leaves things a little short.
Diplomatic there.
Yeah, I'm trying. You know, I mean, there's still Romero involvement. I want to pay my respect. But you know,
did Romero? He did all of the adaptations
of this one.
Of this one, that was a question. I'm sorry. Maybe I said it like a statement, but I'm pretty sure he did all.
You mean
the,
directing?
No, I'm sorry. Writing. He did all the screenplay adaptations, right?
The adaptations of the short stories, you mean? Yeah, because these were Stephen King stories, right? Or at least Chief Woodenhead and The Raft were.
Well, The Raft was the only one that was published.
Okay.
And apparently Chief Woodenhead and what was the other one? The I Need a Ride?
The Hitchhiker.
The Hitchhiker.
Like the Seinfeld guy. Title.
Yeah, exactly. Those two were... either outlines or something. So according to one of Stephen King's biographers, I remember looking this up because I was like, man, what the hell is Woodenhead? I never heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this person said was King wrote a treatment for five stories and a wraparound story that was more complex than the one that was found in the original movie. Romero converted this into a screenplay. The other two stories were adaptations of Cat from Hell and another original story, Pinfall.
Which we got to see in Tales from the Dark Side.
Yeah.
The Pinfall's a zombie bowling story, which I would love to see someone bring to life. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, apparently this is like a treatment. So it would have been Woodenhead and the Hitchhiker as sort of, you know, original teleplays. But the Raft was sort of the only adaptation that sort of made it to screen. Off of Stephen King's short stories, anyway.
I never seen anyone so impatient, Billy, as if your life depended on getting the first copy off the presses.
I guess we'll start with some positives. Well, it's probably going to go right into a negative. There is a spine in this one, right? There is a through line storyline that kind of surrounds everything and binds everything together. However, it blows. The animation is not good.
It felt like it felt like the end of every G.I. Joe episode where it was like they had the little lesson.
Yeah.
Don't skate on the ice, Jimmy, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Don't take
pork chop sandwiches. Yeah.
Nice catch, Blanco Nino. But too bad your ass got sacked.
G.I. Joe.
The animation in this one, I guess, so here's the thing. In Creepshow 1, you know, there isn't necessarily a spine either. It's just they go in and out of a comic book. There's bookends with the Tom Atkins and Stephen King's son.
Right. Joe Hill.
Story. And I guess technically that's what it is here. In this one, they start off with essentially a paper boy or something like going to like and seeing the guy dump the like this
Tom Savini
ghouly
Tom Savini in full ghoul makeup he's the creep
I see he's the creep right okay so you know they see
first
the
edition and you're here so early Billy
He looks like the guy from, or the woman from Princess Bride, who's like in the dream. She's like, "Boo! Yes! Boo!" And like, you know, it's that same like really long like witch nose, yeah, like, yeah. You know, like, yeah. Like man in the moon chin or whatever.
And yeah, like, exactly. Like the dude from McDonald's. Remember the old McDonald's guy?
Mac with... Tonight. Yeah, exactly.
That's the one.
Oh man, I don't know what or how this happened, but my dad ordered, I think, a shirt of Mac Tonight or whatever it's called, from a catalog or whatever, you know, back in the day, and I kept it for so super long, and it shrank, and but Alyssa still wears it, so
gotta get use out of those.
Yeah, yeah,
that's a classic shirt then.
Yeah. No wonder I could come up with that reference so fast. Come on, make it Mac Tonight. The creep in this one, we meet him real quick. He shows up live action and then immediately starts being animated. And you're like, well, why don't we just start as animated?
Yeah, I have a problem with that too. Because the ending then is also live action and it looks like shit.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all the interstitials are animated, every single one of them. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, where that sort of story goes, like I kind of wasn't expecting it to go anywhere and it did. So that was nice. But like, then we get to the sort of last shot there of like the long country road, and it turns back into live action for some reason, and it's not kind of not clear like why, like,
no.
It's not as if he looks at the comic book and we're sucked into the comic book. No, it was just that like the things that were happening in the real life that we've been given just starts being animated all of a sudden. Anyway,
right?
So it just like, even as a film form thing, you're like, well, what if you're gonna do it animated? Just do it animated. I don't understand.
Yeah,
but anyway.
I mean, I'm sure that there was some cost involved or extra cost involved to do that, but, yeah. You know, because they do go to animated in the first Creepshow. It starts with Tom Atkins and Joe Hill, and Joe Hill sees the creep outside his window, and then the creep right. becomes an animated thing.
Well, also in that one, it there's sort of a justification, not only that it's in his comic book, whatever, but, like, you know, he like, you know, gets beat up by his dad. And then he's in his room, you know, he's all upset. And
that's why God made fathers.
He finds an escape through the comic book and, like, and you know,
right.
sees it out the window. And then it sort of, you know, turns into this thing of, like, the comic book comes to life. In this one, it's just, you know, yeah.
He goes like this. He makes, like, some move. And then all of a sudden, animated bats fly at the screen. Yeah. Like, that's
Mac,
really.
Mac the Knight, you know, throws.
Yeah.
throws some newspapers on the ground, and it's like, yeah, okay, now we're animated. All right.
So there was something about this creep, though, that was, because the creep in the first one didn't say anything, had a ghoulish yeah. laugh, you know, and kind of had the hand when it was like, let's get him kind of thing, yeah. you know, with that. But this one, he's got a voice. I'm not sure who voiced it, but the voice doesn't match Tom Savini, that's for sure.
I was about to say, it's not Tom Savini? Okay.
No, he doesn't do the voice. But, you know, it kind of... It lost me a little bit that it had a voice. However, it does harken back more to old EC comics where there's that introduction by either the Crypt Keeper or the Vault Keeper or the old witch. And they would give you, you know, a little blurb about what you're about to watch. Mm-hmm. And this one, they kind of did that too. You know, they did that a little bit more in line with the original comics that they were referencing. In Creepshow, right. the first one, that was just kind of the creep was there. And then all of a sudden we were moving through each of those animated panels, and then we'd be back into the comic book in live action. So a little bit different. But also, you're talking about something that's directed by, you know, George Romero, and then the second one is directed by, I believe, John Harrison?
No, that was Tales from the Dark Side. This is directed by a guy named Michael Gornick.
Okay, Michael Gornick is the DP on Dawn of the Dead. And he directed a few episodes of the series, the TV series of Tales from the Dark Side that Romero produced. And I think that's where he got some of his directing chops. And then he was given this as his first feature.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So, I just looked him up. Yeah, it's like he apparently shot a bunch of stuff for Romero. He shot Martin, Dawn of the Dead.
Knight Riders, I think.
Knight Riders, Creepshow mm-hmm. 1. And Day of the Dead. So there you go.
So let me bring this up too. And I tried not to get super negative on this movie, but I've got problems. And so there was something very special about the first Creepshow and in its cinematography. And it's the use of colored lighting and those colored backdrops that would pop up behind Adrian Barbeau and behind Leslie Nielsen. and it would very much look like a comic book. It was definitely drawn or however that was, and it was a fake background. They didn't have any of that in this. This was just kind of straightforward cinematography, straight, you know, camera now, work, we'll call it.
it's like in Creepshow 1, it's like most of it was sort of straight, but then there'd be these
highlight moments.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the interstitial, you know, changing from one comic book panel to the next, it would go back to the sort of, you know, bright pop of color type of thing. But right. Yeah, you're right. That those moments of style, in that sense anyway, like weren't there.
We should probably get into the actual episodes here.
Yeah. What are we talking about again?
Yeah. So Old Chief Woodenhead, it just kind of falls flat from the get-go for me on this one. The muzak that's playing beyond, you know, the elevator music that's playing throughout the whole thing. I think George Kennedy's performance is really boring. The couple's in general.
So this is like, okay, so George Kennedy, and then his wife is Dorothy L'Amour, and this turned out to be her last movie.
Yeah.
If everyone's been collecting all of their Grindhouse episodes and listening to them faithfully, she was in the movie Donovan's Reef. She was sort of the bar manager there. But I think, you know, most people, if you do know who she is, you probably know her from the sort of like Road to movies, like the Road to Rio, Road to Zanzibar, Road to Bali, whatever. The Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, like sort of loose series. And then, you know, she got her start early on, like playing sort of South Seas, whatever, Native Women or whatever. And, you know, like Donovan's Reef was sort of a weird remake of The Hurricane from the 30s. Anyway, and this turned out to be sort of her last movie. Now, I've kind of felt, even though like there was like no story happening at the very beginning, and it felt really, really long because there was no story happening, like I was kind of interested in the sort of character dynamics that like the sort of George Kennedy and Dorothy L'Amour characters were going through. And then it gets sort of interrupted by this like, oh man, not so great, robbery.
Just like, when they see this hair.
I know my hair.
They're not going to know what to do. It's kind of like the story of Samson,
right? That was the guy
right?
you wanted to name your son after.
Yeah. Colt
McElhenney, right?
McElhenney. Colt.
He wants to go to Hollywood because why? His hair.
But I think he's a good actor, you know? Like, he was great in Fight Club. He was great in that show Mindhunter. He's fantastic. He was in that boxing show that I'm blanking on the name of that was out for, I think, one season. He was excellent in it. That show was amazing. It should have lasted longer than I can't remember the name of, but it was several years ago.
Yeah.
But I had no idea, like, looking back.
If it had lasted longer, you would remember it.
Exactly, yeah. If it did two seasons, yeah. But I had no idea that was him when I rewatched this film, and all of a sudden it was Colt, and I'm like,
Holt.
He's playing a Native American dude.
Yeah.
So explain this to me. You have his uncle cast, clearly a Native American in real life, and then you cast this guy who's supposed to be his nephew, and you go for the American?
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe there were a lot of white people on the other side of the brother's side of the family, or I don't know, or it's just, I mean, I don't know what, like, why, like, I mean, it's like, yeah, exactly, like, what, why cast the most Irish guy ever? I mean, because he was the best on the audition. He looked good with his shirt off.
I really enjoyed when George Kennedy met with Benjamin was his name, the old wise, I guess he's the tribe leader, or I would assume, right? He's the one that kind of runs the government, or that local government there.
Yep.
So he and George Kennedy have a clear relationship. You know, George Kennedy's in this town. This, well, I guess you'd consider it a town. It's like they're in the middle of nowhere where it used to be a town, I guess. But they're running this general store, and this Native American tribe that's on their land clearly really likes this elderly couple. You know, they want to help them out. They give them the family's turquoise and all of their jewelry.
Oh, right.
From, you know, as like, you hold on to this. This is collateral. We're going to hook you up soon. You know, just hold on to this. But just know that these are the precious items from the family. Mm-hmm. And they made a really genuine gesture to him. And I really like that story.
That's what I mean. Like that little bit there.
Yeah.
Like, I was really enjoying the sort of, like, I don't know, kitchen sink drama of it.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, I just think a lot of the specifics of, like, the robbery and, like, the sort of...
Let's talk about the robbery.
Really over-the-top stuff that they were having Holt say about, you know, his hair and all this kind of crap. And, like,
he kept pulling it off his face. And
how he was, you know, robbing them or whatever. And, you know, it's like, also, they kept making it kind of clear that it's not like there's anything really to steal anywhere in this town. So it's like, you know, what were they trying to get away with? I mean,
right.
And,
but they were trying to get the jewels back, right? The family jewels, the family jewelry.
Well, if so, that may have been something that I glazed over when I was watching it. But like when Holt McElhenney was, robbing them, I thought he was just, you know, taking the cash register and like all this kind of stuff. But the whole point is like, it turns out one of his friends is like really rich or whatever. It's like, well,
right.
Why weren't you robbing his parents?
So weird, right? Because
I mean, if anybody has something, it'd be them,
you
right?
you even get that guy's house or, right, you know, with right. his rich parents sitting in the room and he just sneaks out and he's like, why didn't you steal like $1,000 from these people and then go to LA, you know, because that's like their goal, right? Yeah. And I don't know if you know this, but Fatso.
Yeah, Fat Stuff.
Fat Stuff.
That's Hal Holbrook's son. So the connection to Creepshow 1.
Oh, wow.
You know, Hal Holbrook being in The Crate, obviously. But, you know, Crate's a much better episode than this. So, I mean, I think we've kind of laid into Chief Woodenhead enough. There are some neat scenes in it. I really like some of the shots of the... You know, when you see just the shadow of the statue, you know, obviously kind of a golem coming to life.
Sort of like, so, you know, there's that robbery scene, and that is, it feels like it takes forever. It's just like, oh man, this will just not end. Now, when Dorothy L'Amour gets blasted in the side or whatever, like that effect looked great. I mean, it just, it had these little stipples like break through on her apron or whatever. But it, you know, it wasn't like exploding with, you know, guts everywhere necessarily. But it was like, you know, just the way that the you know, bullets ripped her apart was like these little stipples, and it just, you know, as an effect, it looked great. And I think it was like, it was supposed to be the thing where it's like, oh man, the you know, gun went off accidentally or whatever. It was like, you know, escalated. Okay, once that started happening, and then we get the, you know, the wooden chief on outside, like, you know, kind of coming to life. The transition from the sort of stiff and like motionless puppet to, you know, either the mobile puppet or like a guy wearing a suit.
Right.
Was a really cool transition.
Yeah.
And then you get the sort of series of kills.
Which are great.
Taking out Rich Boy, Fat Stuff, and My Hair.
It's really cool because he uses a bow and arrow. He uses the hatchet or the axe, you know, like there's some tomahawk. There's some really cool stuff in there.
Well, and it's like, you know, the Rich Boy goes to his garage.
Yeah.
We see the garage door open, the headlights are on, and then we see the shadow kill him. And so we don't see it happen. And it's like, you know,
and then the door really closes cool, and then it's like,
yeah, exactly.
The silhouette. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
I'm forgetting what the Fat Stuff one was.
That was that bow and arrow. He was sitting like eating food and all of a sudden you hear and he's like, I thought that was a good one.
No, you know, it was great. And then, you know, Holt McElhenney was like pulled through the wall. That was awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
that was a great fight.
I mean, that little series of bits, you're like, wow, that was the part that
get
was
to
like,
it.
Where they needed to get to. And it's like, and everything else they needed to kind of, they really needed to trim that robbery down. It's like, geez.
Yeah.
Or you could have just had him rob them and we didn't need to know exactly what they were up to. You know what I mean? It's like...
Exactly. It could have been a random robbery.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did like that there was some of that added stuff and the fact that the Benjamin, the uncle, does come back to visit the elderly couple, finding that they're dead or finally seeing that they're dead, but then seeing Chief Woodenhead holding the scalp of his nephew, you know, and then he gives him the... you know, whatever, goodbye or blessing or whatever. Yeah. And he's like, see you later, Chief. You know, you're a good man. And it's like, I'm not going to mess with this wooden puppet anymore because just fucked up three people, right?
Right, exactly.
Now, may your spirit rest, old warrior. Akkoane. Akkoane.
Ray and Martha Spruce, like that was that name is very Stephen King because, you know, Stephen King's wife, Tabitha, like her maiden name was Spruce. And I thought that the idea was that only one of the stories, The Raft, was adapted from Stephen King, and the other two were just, you know, sort of made for this movie. But like, but because that name was in there, I was like, wait a minute. This must have been a Stephen King story.
Right.
Like, where the hell did this come from? But it turns out it was just sort of like an outline that he put some bullet points down and Romero adapted it to screen type of thing.
So the... As we get further into the story, we get a little bit more from the rapper story with this little boy who's being harassed by this group of punks. Yeah. And in order to do that, he goes into his Creepshow magazine into the back and he orders some man-eating plant seeds.
Right.
Which he, you know, gets from the post office, and then he's all of a sudden beaten up by these kids, loses those seeds,
right.
And like, you know, then he needs to run.
Yeah.
Right, and then we're into the next story, so that was like the little tidbit there, and then we're into The Raft. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite of the three.
Yeah.
I think that's the most complete, and I feel really bad for those actors because it was clearly really cold out in that water, and they had well, you know, their skivvies on.
It was supposed to be in the story, but yeah, it's usually like when that happens, like on a set or whatever, it's like, oh, a scene that's supposed to be hot, it's freezing cold, and a scene that's supposed to be cold is like blazing hot. But in this case, a scene that was supposed to be cold was actually really cold.
Don't they look cold
when you watch
them? Like some of them can't move; like they can hardly give their lines.
Well, and supposedly, like the I don't know, whatever. I can't remember his name. Like Randy, the character name.
Randy, yeah.
So Randy, the actor played that.
Got hypothermia or something.
Got hypothermia.
Yeah.
During the shoot, and it was like,
yeah. I don't think the shoot went very well.
Yeah.
Like from the get go, I think that they lost locations. It was cold when it wasn't supposed to be. The hitchhiker side it was all black ice out on the, and it's all a driving segment, so you can't drive safely on that.
Yeah.
You know. But this one was good. You mentioned that you read this one, and I think that there's some stuff that's lost a little bit because, you know, between writing and reading what someone's mm-hmm. writing and then, you know, seeing it on screen, there's a little bit more to that oil slick than just being a big tarp that's floating in the water. It's actually like hypnotizing, right? Like iridescent colors that come off of it, and it actually hypnotized the mm-hmm. girl, and they show that. And I think
that's
the most effective kill in this movie is when you see her slowly getting pulled down into the water and she just looks and she's like, it hurts. And that's all she says. That was pretty hard to watch, but very effective.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's actually, you know, in a lot of ways, it's very true to how the short story plays out. There is sort of a bigger emphasis on how seductive the mysterious monstrous oil slick is, and like, you know, that's the thing that gets the first woman. Was it Rachel or Laverne? I can't remember. Well, the first one who goes down, like, you know,
Rachel's the one that gets killed first.
Kind of like, Oof. Drawn to it, and they do play that in the movie. Now they kind of have that be more of a thing in the short story, especially because you know how they sort of like survive overnight, and like, you know, then it's like, you know, they're delirious, and then on top of that there's this like, you know, weird power that it has to kind of like, you know, almost Dracula like be able to hypnotize you.
Ow! Get away from there, Rachel. Die!
Did she fall in? Help! It hurts!
No, Franny! No!
It hurts!
And there's the very rapey sex scene or whatever it was.
Which is in the story, actually, right?
No. There is a sex scene in the story, but it's not rape like this. It's not like...
Oh, really?
She's
okay.
Not passed out, and it's not... he's like just feeling her up, and I don't know.
Fuck.
In the short story, it's like this, like... And something that kind of happens in King short stories or King stories in general. Essentially, it was like this sort of survival thing. They were you know, huddling together, you know, hugging for warmth. And then, you know, in these like extremely stressful situations, a lot of times in King stories, that does lead to, you know, things getting like unexpectedly horny. And they did that. And then, of course, like it's like, yeah, I think we can make it. I think we can make it. And her hair gets pulled out, right? And it's like, oof, this whole thing.
I think the whole side of her face got screwed up in that one. She like turns over and
right.
She's just...
Well, because in this one, like they just fall asleep. And I was like, wait, I thought you had to stay between the boards. That was the whole reason Deke gets sucked down.
Right. Oh, man. We didn't mention that.
Yeah.
When his leg pops straight up, when he falls.
No,
man.
Yeah. That was great. But for me, the best part with Deke was that like, his hand gets sucked down and his ring stays
the
behind.
The ring.
Yeah.
That was really cool. See, this movie has some moments, right? There's some real highlights in this one.
No, totally.
It looks like it's going under the raft, man. And I'm going to swim for it right now.
No! Don't leave us here. Don't!
I'm fast and I can make it. You got to go while it's underneath the raft.
So after the Deke thing, the idea is that, like, in the short story, what was great was that, like, Laverne watched Deke get sort of sucked through that thing. Well, because Rachel, like, falls over the side, and then they don't really see how bad it really was or something in the short story. And then, like, and then with the Deke one, it was just, like, right in front of their face. And because of that, you know, sort of Laverne, like, you know, screams so much she passes out. And Randy's, like, holding her. And standing between the boards so that it doesn't get him. And, like, you know, his muscles are, like, you know, almost, like, you know, giving out. And then the whole idea is that they cannot, you know, like, lay down like that. And so they have this whole taking turns, like, standing up and whatever. Now, what's kind of great about that is that, like, you know, kind of like how Night of the Living Dead works. You spend all this time with the machinations of, like, the humans that are in the survival mode here. And, like, you know, how they're sort of battling it out amongst each other, and those personalities get in the way of it, and, you know, it gives something for the audience to, like, kind of cling on to here. In this one, it's like they are the only two left, and then they can just lay down for no reason, and then she passes out and he wakes up and he's like, hey, I'm horny now, let me start playing with her. And she keeps murmuring no, and you're like, oh god, it doesn't go anywhere other than, like, you know, she gets sort of sucked into the goo. But it makes for this weird moment with the character you're following. And maybe they wanted you to have that feeling for him so that you wouldn't feel too bad when the tidal wave gets him.
Yeah, exactly. I don't. Yeah.
I beat you.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, like.
That was an interesting adaptation. And I feel like that part kind of makes it make sense for the adaptation. Because it's like, you know, in the story, essentially, it sort of ends with, like, kind of ambiguously. But it gives you the sense that, well, he's going to get seduced by this thing as well, because he's sort of the last man standing.
I beat you. What if you... I beat you!
But in this one, it's like, you know, she's getting eaten, and it's on the other side of the raft. Like, he jumps off and swims the other way.
He
like thinks about it at one point. He's like, damn it, we should have done that when it was eating Deke. It was like, we should have just,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you know, you didn't think about it in time, and then you're too late and you're screwed. And what's great is he makes it to shore, but like, he doesn't like climb up close enough to the car. But I love all those little shots of like seeing how close yet how far the car is. And
yeah.
Like, and the car just represents, like, you know, they can get away, but
safety,
they can't.
Yeah,
they can't.
Yeah,
they're stuck.
I thought the ending was great. You know, the tarp comes out of the water, covers him up, and it goes back, and then all of a sudden you see that the radio is still in the car. You know, the car's battery's about to die, and then it slides past, and it's like, no swimming.
Yeah, right.
thought that was great.
That was a great ending to it. That it made it work, especially for this medium, because like, you know, just having if it had just been sort of a one for one literal adaptation of him sort of, you know, being hypnotized and like it's over,
right?
That's not the same thing as, you know, you can experience it differently as a you know, as a story versus you know, a movie.
Now I think you need a punchy ending in these, right? Like right. You need a clear cut end. And that was it.
But I mean, I don't know. It's like you could have the sort of like, well, it sucks, but the thing got all of them ending without having Randy be so rapey.
Correct.
You know what
absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely. Like,
you know,
yes.
I know. It's very weird. Yeah.
It's a real like, I don't know, scab on this episode. You know, like it's like the one thing you're just like,
Oh man. Okay. So the thing we didn't talk about though was the very opening of this, you know, because it starts, you know, each one starts with a still image on paper, and then it turns into a freeze frame, and that animates the life, right? And this one, you know, it starts with that car driving on that winding road, and, you know, first of all, it's like, you know, everyone's passing around a joint, and they're like, I feel the need for weed. God, it's so great.
Oh, I actually liked that actor. I thought he was funny.
Yeah. But like, how much did that feel like the opening of Evil Dead?
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, that's, you know, going to the cabin, the group of kids, like it was the same exact thing, right? I mean, that you can kind of buy into that, you know, you can kind of feel for those kids because you've gone on road trips, you've gone and hung out, you've gone camping or whatever that might be.
Yeah.
You might not have gone to some watering hole, but you know, you can kind of understand where these kids are coming from and like,
yeah,
just trying to get away. It's clearly like a late summer or a late year hot day that they're taking advantage of, but
exactly
it didn't work out quite well.
And it was like, you know, it was like an impulse. They were all just hanging out and they're like, oh, what if we go to the lake or whatever? And you know, they had that thought out there, like, well, we didn't tell anybody we were going, and it was like, no one's gonna know we're missing. You know, it's like,
God,
yeah,
terrifying.
It's great. I mean, I, you know, there's a lot of great stuff in it, but yeah, I mean, it's. I guess you're right. There's that little slash on the pot there with with the unfortunate Randy scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can cut that out in a further edit.
Having characters do things that I don't agree with or whatever, it happens in almost all of these stories. But like in this case, it felt like it served no purpose. It was a very strange.
Who
like,
the fuck is going to get horny when there's a oil slick that's digesting your friends right like feet away from you in the water? Like, I'm sorry, but that, you know, is that gets rid of boners. It doesn't create them, you know, like it's
right.
Well, come on, man.
And also just the like, I don't know, she's passed out. The whole thing. It was like, what the
yeah,
fuck?
No, I know that it's the one piece of this one that I really didn't like.
Hey, buddy. What the fuck happened?
Looks like a hit and run.
Yeah. Car blew by me a little while ago. Couldn't see the lights. Don't know what the hell it was.
I do want to go into the hitchhiker.
Yeah. Well, it's great. It's like the opening, it does what Stephen King does so well, which is like it gets you invested in the sort of kitchen sink drama. It's like this woman, you know, who's just cheating on her husband, and oh shit, she needs to get home fast, or he's
with a gigolo that charges by the orgasm. I thought that was funny.
That was awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
And how she's talking to herself, she's like, listen, it's six orgasms, you don't understand. Yeah, that was great.
You charged by the orgasm?
Good idea. Maybe I should. Then at least I'd have something to work for.
Also, like, on the gigolo's nightstand behind him was a
beat-up
copy of It. You know, he's like, obviously, you know, making his way
through
that one.
There.
Yeah. It's very Stephen King in a certain way. I mean, because
is this all happening in her head?
This
you
is
know?
Also exactly one of those where it's like, you know, like just like in Tales of Terror and just like in Tales from the Hood, if we ever get there, it's like, you know, there's a lot of things where it feels like, you know, is this only happening in her head? And like, is this a manifestation of her guilt or whatever?
Yeah.
Damn!
Then later, you know, we see Stephen King coming out. He's driving his like Maximum Overdrive truck.
Yeah, exactly. That's what.
And like, and then there's like this weird
kind of a Geordie Verrill, kind of a meteor ship.
Exactly, because he's just like, he's very like, you know, exaggerated and like and funny.
Hey, what's happening?
What do you think's happening? The guy got creamed. That's what happened. It happens all the time.
But there's something like very sort of ominous about that line, right? It's like, you know, because there's a hit and run victim on somebody who was like walking on the side of the road, which, you know, fast forward to 11 years after this, that victim was him.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Man, that's, yeah, I didn't even think about that.
It's interesting watching it in retrospect and like, and then thinking about that and like the way that, that this thing went down, you know, it was something right out of one of his stories.
Think rationally. Can you live with this? That's the question. The guy's dead. No, you don't actually know that. You don't know that. You're certain.
She's being haunted by this hitchhiker who keeps, he has this one line that he keeps saying, "Thanks for the ride, lady." And you know, there's,
even though he's getting more fucked up, it's still
yeah,
like,
I love it. By the end of it, he's basically a tongue that's saying, "Oh, that's
blah, blah, blah."
I got a complaint about that too. They kind of held on that last shot a little too long with the puppet that comes through the window. But overall, this was a really effective piece, I think, and it really does kind of
really
lean
effective
into
piece of native advertising for Mercedes because
exactly
you couldn't kill this car.
Yeah, you can't break down a Mercedes. It got all the way home.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. She smashed into a tree 40 times, and yeah.
But the reason I bring up the fact that this is kind of could be all in her head is that she constantly hits this guy. She did kill him, right? But this guilt is driving her nuts. So she thinks that this hitchhiker keeps following
and she
her.
She shoots him like 400 times too. And
right,
it's like,
she shoots him. She hits him in the tree, you know, multiple times against. Like there are some really really graphic scenes in this one.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was really interesting because at the end, even though she's all, you know, covered in the zombie hitchhiker, she died from carbon monoxide poisoning. She's just dead in her car from the car running inside the garage.
Yeah.
So it goes right back to, did she kill herself, you know, either intentionally or unintentionally because of that? Or, you know, like it's a lot more to it.
And, you know, she had his sign or whatever. And it's like
the Dover sign,
sort of manifestation of his guilt. And like Stephen King does that a lot or has done that before in I'm thinking of Storm of the Century.
OK.
Long, complicated story. But there's one sort of minor character who got in a bar fight and ended up killing a guy or whatever. And like he, after this crazy event that happens through the entire show, we see his fate, which is that, you know, he sort of kills himself the way, you know, he accidentally killed the Skeller guy. And like, so it's like, you know, he has this like, you know, I don't know, penance through like a dramatic irony. It's like,
right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting, I guess, device that he uses a lot and he kind of does it here. And you're right. Like what's kind of cool is that we see, or what it seems to be, or my interpretation of it, I should say, is that, yeah, it's like we are seeing her sort of guilt over what she did, you know, haunting her. And, you know, again, that sort of gothic idea of like these things that are horrifying and seem to be happening in real life, you know, are also could be read as just happening in her head, you know.
There's a lesson for you, kiddies. Never pick up hitchhikers on the hood of your car.
I mean, let's finish up the spine, if you will, or that rapper.
Yeah.
This kid who's running away from these thugs, these bullies, all of a sudden runs into a patch of grass that is now infested by giant man-eating plants.
That are
I mean, honestly, I mean, that's a big swing,
yeah.
But it's animated, so why not? Go for it.
You can
thought,
do anything you want, yeah.
I've been waiting for you, boys.
So even though it took us this long to get to this one, I'd say that this is probably the best movie out of the group. In my opinion, yeah. Definitely the best one. And I hadn't seen this movie, Tales from the Hood, since it originally came out. So, 95?
Same.
Is that right?
So, yeah, exactly. I saw it when it came out, although I have sort of no memory. So I only sort of remember the sort of the first prologue with, you know, introducing, you know, Clarence Williams III. The
God, is he good.
The cop one, exactly. Man. And then the David Alan Grier.
Yeah.
The abuser. It's like it's all fucked up. I mean,
yeah.
And for some reason, maybe I fell asleep. I don't know what, or maybe I just don't remember him. But like, I don't remember the last ones. And I had forgotten that I had seen this movie. So like, it's like I, you know,
was it coming back to you as you're watching
it? It was all coming back as I was watching it. Yeah, exactly. I was like, wow. Okay.
I know what's going to happen next. Am I psychic?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Adam kind of described this on our Tom Atkins show, where he's like talking about how like Night of the Creeps. He's like, yeah, I forgot that I had seen it, and like, you know, it was like something like, you know, this imagery in his head or whatever. He's like, oh, that's what it was from.
Yeah.
You know, I'd gotten that a couple times in this one. And, you know, it's like, I definitely remember Clarence Williams III as this, like, you know, psychotic guy in the mortuary and, like, not blinking. But for some reason, I thought maybe that I'd seen that, like, a music video or something. Like, it just, like, it wasn't, like, registering that it was from this movie.
Shit. The shit, the drugs. You get the drugs, then I get the money. Okay. You know, this is all new to me. I'm not a drug dealer. I'm a mortician.
This is a perfect example of how you do the rapper properly,
yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
It starts with that. It sets everything up. It comes back to that as more stories are being told. He's clearly telling the stories or at least telling these folks about, you know, these three guys that are visiting him mm-hmm. to try to get the shit.
Yeah.
He's telling them all this, you know, very, you know, urban focused, I guess, lore.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me a lot of, and it's funny because the newer Twilight Zone that came out that Jordan Peele did, you know, it said mm-hmm. it was, you know, breaking all this ground by, you know, making these, you know, predominantly people of color cast mm-hmm. and all this stuff. And it's like, Tales from the Hood did this in 95.
Yeah.
Guys. Let's slow down a second here.
What's frustrating is like, there have been a lot of movies like this, but that, like, I don't know, didn't make that their sales pitch the way that they're being made now. And it's like, you know, it's like, okay, fine. You know, it's like,
right.
Fine.
Right.
You
right.
want to sell the movie that way. That's one thing, but don't pretend like that, like this is the first time it's ever been done. Like,
exactly. You know what I mean? Like, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, anyway,
yeah, an easy Google search would tell you that you are wrong. Right. I mean,
yeah.
And, but I think in general, this movie has it all. It's very gritty.
Yeah.
The acting's great, even if it's over the top, but it works for a movie of this type. Yeah. All of the sequences are good, and they all, you know, run together really well. I mean, we should get into it.
Yeah.
You know, the rogue cop. Start with that
rogue
one.
Rogue cop revelation.
Yeah, that's right.
I've got nothing against good cops.
You what?
I said I've got nothing against good cops, but I will see lowlife scum like you run out of the department. You shut the fuck up.
One black cop in the rogue cop revelation story. God, I was like, God, he looks so familiar. And I like looked up his IMDb. I was like, nah, this isn't looking right. But it turns out he's like a stand-up. He's a comic.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, God, okay, that's probably what I saw him from. I mean, and how interesting was that, you know, both him and, you know, David Alan Grier, you know, both stand-up
comedic.
Comics playing
yeah.
very sort of straight roles, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are some sort of ironically funny things that happen with the David Alan Grier character. You know, it's just like, or he has these little moments, like certain little punchlines or whatever. And, you know, it's not like a well-delivered joke, but just like, I don't know, his like presence, like it makes it funny. But like, definitely with the Anthony Griffith part in Rogue Cop, you know, there wasn't really any of that in there. And he plays it so straight, you know, from the beginning as the sort of like, you know, very green rookie cop to like the, you know, broken down alcoholic And then the sort of like, you know, a straight jacketed padded room, like almost Arkham Asylum type, you know.
Right, yeah.
Like completely broken from reality at the very end there. The whole time, you would never guess he was a comedian. I mean, it's like, and that's probably why, like, I was like, looking at his IMDb, I'm like, this isn't, not this. What do I know him from, you know?
Yeah, I like this one a lot because it kind of flipped the script a little bit. You know, the actual comeuppance in this one was that black cop, because he didn't act when he had the opportunity to act, when, you know, at the beginning during this traffic stop that clearly was turning bad, especially during the 90s now, in LA. I think that that's clearly what they were getting at. But, you know, he didn't act. And I think that that was obviously the main point.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, what, two or three years after
Rodney King yeah.
And, like, and, you know, this is, so Tom Wright, the George's, you know, boss for a little while at the Yankee Stadium. Also, thanks for the ride, lady. He gets pulled over and it turns out for no reason. And the reason was to harass him. And then the accelerates and accelerates to the point where they kill him. And Officer Smith, or, you know, the Anthony Griffith character, you know, was complacent and all that. But he also was the only one who felt guilty about it, and like kind of like did the thing where it's like, oh, bring them to me.
Clarence, bring them to me. Bring them to me.
The music choices in this one were so interesting. Like, you know, not only some of the needle drops, like, you know, Strange Fruit and some of the hip hop tracks that we were hearing, you know, as like source music, the music by Christopher Young. I mean, I'm familiar with his work a little bit, but like the thing I remember most for is The Gift, the Sam Raimi movie that sort of like,
which I haven't seen yet. You've mentioned that one.
Okay. Yeah. It's like this, interesting period of Sam Raimi in between sort of the Evil Dead world and then, you know, Spider-Man or whatever. It's like, you know, he had this period of time where he was doing some, very different genres than you'd suspect. But anyway, in that one, it had a kind of similar sound to it. You know, it has this like very heavy sound, but then also kind of a country twang to it. And, like, you know, it's really interesting, like contrast to things. But anyway, the music moments during that beatdown, like the fact that we kind of like switch into, you know, like, you know, whatever, 200 frames a second or whatever, as his head goes through the window, and like, you know, just there's all these like little moments. I, you know, definitely as a kid I didn't appreciate this, but like, you know, kind of watching it again as an adult, like you really appreciate the sort of cinema of this movie.
You expect us to believe you're talking to this dead fucker?
Quite frankly, I don't know what to expect. My orders were to get you out here. I'm good at that, you know. Following orders.
One last thing on the rogue cop, was great was that, well, maybe two last things. One was like, one of the cops, like Wing Hauser's partner, I was like, it was killing me. I was like, who is this guy? And he's like, oh, he was the spiders caused himself a couple of flies from Pulp Fiction.
You know? Yeah.
He was the guy who calls Zed.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the guy who gets, you know, grabbed by the nuts and pulled down into the grave.
Dragged. Yeah, yeah,
when he gets to the cemetery. Then the other two cops like flee. While they're running away, they keep seeing Tom Wright, you know, appearing in different places and on their windshield, yeah, whatever, and like on their sunroof, and like, or you know, grabbing him through the
thanks for the ride, lady.
And it was exactly like it must have been a nod to Thanks for the Ride, Lady.
So what kind of problem are we talking about?
Well, aside from the bruises, aside from that, there's this monster that he says is in the house. He seems very disturbed by it. In fact, he's even drawn a picture of the monster.
Let's talk about David Alan Greer beating up his son. I think that was the next one, right? Boys do get bruised.
Yeah. So, in this one, it's the director.
The director.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of cast himself.
Yeah.
as the teacher. Yeah. This was one that I like really. I was like, God, where was this imagery from? And it was from this movie. And it was like, you know, the kid you know, he keeps claiming that it's a monster or whatever, and then he like sees the monster under the door and like all the like all the like sound design of a monster coming home. And then sort of the reveal that, you know, that monster is, you know, sort of an abusive stepfather.
I believe it is
his dad. It wasn't super clear on that. But anyway.
Father figure. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it had such a great payoff from the like the drawing that like messed up the bully.
Right.
That then, you know, it turned into, you know, like how Dag got his comeuppance. And
kind of like a kind of a voodoo ish thing, right? But this was the Rusty kind of the director advised the kid. He's like, you can get rid of some of these, you know, issues in your mind if you literally throw them away or destroy them,
right?
You know, yeah, like physically.
It's like it's almost something you'd get in therapy. It was like, well, you know,
right.
talk about the thing you want, and by talking about it, it kind of like helps exercise it out. And like,
and instead of this, he turns David Alan Grier into a puddle.
Exactly. Gets sort of literalized into this horror moment. It's great horror.
Great effects.
And
great effects.
And you know, there's this terrible scene where like, you know, David Alan Grier is just going absolutely apeshit and like beating the shit out of everybody. He grabs the frying pan, like to hit his wife with it or whatever. And then all of a sudden, like they fold that that paper, and his arm just like. The imagery and like the bone crunching sounds or whatever of him getting twisted there, like that was all like it, you know, buried in my memory. You know, it's like, and at the time I was only aware of David Alan Grier from like
In Living Color, yeah.
And like, you know, it's like, you know, I was like, man, I mean,
he's got chops.
That was the guy. I was like, I was fully aware that he was a comedian while watching it, even in the 90s.
Yeah.
But you believe him as this character. Like he's, you know what I mean? He's so vicious.
Oh yeah.
But I also love how like toward the very, very end, you know, he hadn't been sort of burned up yet. You know, he's in this like puddle of his own, you know, like his own skin and like, you know, busted bones, and he's still like threatening them or whatever. And he looked like Judge Doom from Roger Rabbit.
But what's cool is that, you know, we see his burned body and that's kind of the end of the segment, but then we go back to the mortuary again and we see his burned body in the casket. Yeah. So it starts like coming together, right? That he's talking about all these dead bodies, but for some reason this strange mortician has all of these bodies and has all these stories and knows that. And then we start, you know, continuing on with more story. Obviously this one I thought was absolutely hilarious. The KKK comeuppance.
Yeah.
What a great title, too.
It's disturbing enough that Duke Metger would claim residency here just for the sake of gaining racist votes. But the real slap in the face to the black community is that he chose this house, this former plantation, with its history of racism towards black people to set up camp.
Can anything be done?
Well, there are certain things that we plan to do.
There ain't nothing we need to do. They're gonna take care of it. They're gonna make him pay for being here.
Who will make him pay, sir?
The souls. The souls are gonna make him pay. They're gonna make him pay for being here. Miss Cobb was the keeper of the souls. And now there's no peace. There was peace, but there's no peace in the dollhouse now.
The dollhouse?
The dollhouse. They're gonna make him pay the dollhouse.
The story actually kind of reminded me of Battleground, which is a Stephen King short story in Night Shift, I think. And then it got turned into, there was like a mini series of mostly stuff from Nightmares and Dreamscapes. It was like, you know, it's kind of a made for TV little miniseries thing. And what's funny is it was one of these like sort of concept episodes where they got William Hurt to be in it, but he didn't say a single word. He just kind of came home and like these things were attacking him and like he just had to sort of deal
with
it.
The dolls or?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a doll like situation, but they were like these like, you know, little tanks and shit.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, but this is great, and like I love the guy from Do the Right Thing. He's like Martin, like that guy. You know, as yeah. as this really like scumbag, you know, like you know, a consultant, like a political consultant.
Listen, by the time I finish with you, you might even get a few black folks in the till.
Well, start would be just getting the bastards off my front lawn.
Like, mm-hmm. you know, he's the first guy to get it, and he gets it real good, and like, you know, he just like, just eats it all the way down the stairs, and like, you know, lands on his neck.
Yeah, they weren't afraid of showing, you know, bones bending the wrong direction in this movie, and yeah. a lot of great sound design of cracking of bones,
yeah,
and
yeah.
like creating or turning people into liquid, more right. or less.
Well, and I love all the puppets in this. I love the sort of stop yeah. motion, and you know, all the sort
creepy,
of, the interesting blending of all those effects and whatever.
Yeah,
and like how you know the faces weren't like animated, but they would definitely sort of change. From
yes.
one cut to the next type of thing.
Yeah, they didn't need to move in camera. They just needed yeah. to have the right expression
right.
for exactly. whatever the, action they were doing.
That's a better way to put it, yeah. Exactly, the expression
yeah.
would change.
Yeah, I love that. I thought that yeah. that was strong. Plus, I mean, I'm sure it probably helped the animators, and they're like, okay, yeah. good, we don't need to do the talking. That's good.
Yeah,
we don't need
that's easy. Here, yeah. we have like four heads. We'll just switch it out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, which is probably what they did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I also love just the, I don't know what, the very... in-your-face imagery, like not being subtle with their messaging on this one.
When he covered himself in an American flag yeah. and then is devoured,
and
you know?
He takes the American flag and he's like beating the painting with it and he tries to like smash yeah. one of the dolls with it. Like, yeah, exactly.
It's chaotic.
Yeah.
This one had a lot of Evil Dead feel to it, like the very kinetic type action.
Maybe more like Army of Darkness where it's like, you know, he's like,
yeah.
he's like fighting the little versions of
yeah,
himself.
Exactly. Like, yeah, exactly. The mini ashes, yeah.
It's very comical to look at because like this like, giant guys like fighting these you know like 3-inch dolls
Gulliver's
or whatever
travels yeah, kind yeah, of thing yeah, yeah.
but like yeah. you know it is also scary at the same time so like
I mean that would be one of the scariest things ever like when you I think all of these are like that
yeah.
when you put it you know you could laugh at the dolls then they're stupid mm-hmm. and all that but like just put yourself in that position and if those things
yeah.
were coming at you like
well and how great was
terrified.
Sort of the reveal of like he comes back into the yeah. room at one point he's all you know kind of beat up and like the painting has all the dolls removed from it
yes
or whatever.
God that was awesome
yeah. and then you know the army charges
I love the motif in movies where artwork changes
yeah.
and
yeah.
you know just because something's missing and then they're like wait a second yeah. and then all of a sudden that thing is out of the painting yeah. you know I think that's great.
Cain was the world's first murderer. He slayed his brother. And how many brothers have you slain?
Just like maybe in the next one and in the Rogue Cop, maybe these things didn't happen with the zombie
yeah.
Morehouse, like the mm-hmm. George's boss from Seinfeld. Like maybe that stuff didn't happen. And maybe it was just that, you know, the Anthony Griffith character was going around, you know, killing all these guys.
Right.
And we kind of don't know. And like it, again, sort of like how we've been talking about with both Tales of Terror and in the Hitchhiker of Creepshow 2, you know, these things may or may not have like, you know, just been part of this the guilt of the characters or the conscience of the characters. You know, I don't think that necessarily applies in Boys Don't Get Bruised, but definitely in Comeuppance and in Hardcore Convert and like Rogue Cop.
Right.
Like all of them. And then even in the wraparound, I guess, like the idea of like what the audience is experiencing as sort of literal horror, you know, could also just be this like the psychological
cognitive or,
you know,
yeah.
like. Breakdown of what's happening or sort of the perspective of these things are like of a guilty conscience, you know?
I mean, Hardcore Convert probably is that to the fullest,
yeah.
right? I don't think there's anything really happening in this episode, right? This is all kind of in a fantasy
yeah.
world.
Or it's like, yeah, like the whatever it's called, that moment of time as you're expiring.
Right.
We're
the flash.
Yeah.
Kind of limbo. I'm thinking of the middle ground between here and the other side, right?
Yeah.
And it's like that's that one last step that you have to kind of face all your
right,
face your judgment.
The sort of DMT is kicking in exactly like you're
right exactly
you're
yeah
going through all this stuff and you know you can see in certain moments when Rosalyn Cash is really giving it to him. How
good was she?
Oh man.
She, so awesome.
I mean, really, it's like,
yeah,
you know, She was definitely good in Omega Man and whatever, but like in this one, you know, she really cranks it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, she was
yeah.
front and center as a, you know, showing off those acting chops.
Yeah, totally. And when she's yelling at Jerome there and like getting him to sort of make the connection of you know, his violence and, you know, other forms of violence. Oh man, and how great was the guy in the sort of hamster cage next to him, the sort of the white
yeah.
supremacist, you know, like, oh my God, he was so good. He was such like a terrifying character.
I mean, that was very much like what happens in prison, right? Like you start meeting,
no.
you know, your neighbors, and there's those conversations, and that was kind of what we got.
Well, look what we have here. The first soldier in my army, perhaps. You gotta be really bad to be in a place like this, otherwise you wouldn't be here. So what'd you do? What you in for?
Murder, punk. And I wouldn't mind doing this shit again.
Me either. I killed a lot of people. You wanna know what kind? Come over here, I'm gonna show you something. What's wrong? Are you afraid of me?
My favorite part of this one was sleep or the deprivation chamber.
Yeah.
I always like that, again, a motif in movies where it's all black around you and there seems to be like a wetness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like almost like you're in water, but you can't see the water. You don't really know. And he's in this like pure black thing where he's just being assaulted
yeah.
by all of the victims that he's, you know, caused problems to over
the
course
of
his
sort of seizure-inducing strobe light sequence.
Exactly, yeah. I thought that was amazing.
That was great. Well, and then also like the, like sort of the Parallax Corporation almost, you know, brainwashing video that they played in the Parallax Corporation.
Yeah.
They had a very similar
exactly,
vibe
yeah.
to it. It was like, you know, cutting between, well, are we making the connection here between sort of, you know, lynchings and like, you know, the sort of violence that Crazy K was, you know, in on. What I love about a lot of the sequence is that like once they take him out of the regular prison where he's doing 5,000 sit-ups or whatever, and they get him to the sort of Arkham prison, it becomes so Terry Gilliam. It looked like the future from 12 Monkeys.
Right.
But what's crazy is like it's not as if he was inspired by that, because why? These movies came out the same year. Yeah, I mean, it was just, I don't know. What was happening in 1995?
Is that mostly like shooting close up with a wide angle lens to give it that kind of wrapping kind
there's
of...
There's that, but also just the sort of like combination of, I don't know, old industrial, you know, iron works plus, you know, kind of a mad scientist technology.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And like the sort of all the workers had like lab coats and whatever. It was very mm-hmm. much like 12 Monkeys in the future.
Mm-hmm.
The hamster cages that he and the white supremacist were, Crazy K and the white supremacists were in. I mean, that all felt like the future in 12 Monkeys. It was wild. And I think part of it, yeah, it's that wide angle thing, but also just the strange production design similarities, like the coincidence of the similarities there. But anyway, it was a really great episode overall. I mean, you know, it's like all those things like happening and like you know, shaving his head and like, you know, cranking that, you know, the book press on his dick and like, you know,
yeah.
like hooking up to diodes and like putting shit up his nose and like, you know, and then we cut to and it's like he's in that space, like you're saying, and it's like, is it wet? Like, what am I seeing? Like, what's there?
Are you floating? Are you laying down?
And, you know, there is this idea that, like, you know, was he given a chance there to repent? As we see, he's like the mantra he's like chanting inside of his perhaps dreamscape is what he's chanting as he's laying on the pavement as well
by three gunmen
yeah.
who then we find out are main people that are in the mortuary that we're following from the beginning of the movie. It comes together so nicely in this one.
Yeah.
Probably the best out of most of the ones we've watched, especially the ones today.
Yeah.
but then we go right back into the mortuary and we learn who Clarence actually is.
Well,
you're in hell, motherfuckers.
Yeah. One of the best lines. Best line readings, too.
Yes! Ain't no funeral home!
What's so great about like the wraparound story, just like with Tales from the Crypt, the 70s Tales from the Crypt, like there is a point where, like, wait a minute. What do we keep coming back to this for? It's like, right. It seems like they should be advancing this thing.
Right.
And the interstitial segments, the wraparound segments, get shorter and shorter and shorter until we get to the part where we answer that question.
Right.
So it feels like satisfying. But what's kind of great about it is, like, the way the movie opens, you know, it feels very much like a music video from the time. It feels also like this thing where it's like, as a zeitgeist, especially at that time, like, you know, like, what's the most terrifying thing that the average person can think of? And this is the imagery that you can think of. And what's great is, like, you start with that imagery and then you take it into, you know, what's even scarier? Well, it's just the unblinking Clarence Williams III with, tobacco leaves on his teeth. And he's just like, you know, dressed like Vincent Price and, with Don King's hair. And he's, you know, this completely, you know, nutty character who's like terrifying these guys. And then we find out that he's actually just Tim Curry from Legend.
Yeah, he does kind of become Tim Curry from Legend. But it is a good reveal. Yeah. And I think that the whole wall getting blown out, and it's like a real shitty green screen from the 90s, but it still is so great because just chaos. And I love the
very
end.
First thing is, like, they do the, like, his, like, sort of snake tongue comes out of, like, the gap in his teeth or whatever. They sort of play on that. I'm like, oh, man. If the line is "Welcome to Hell, motherfuckers," like that's the kind of, like, you know, metal reveal you'd want anyway, where it's like, you know,
for sure.
Like, you don't want to take it too seriously, you know what I mean?
It's like, no, you want horns, you want flames, you want red, you want demons. Yeah, you want the whole schmear.
Exactly.
Welcome to hell.
I think we did it, Jeremy. It only took us an hour and 46 minutes. Honestly, man, there was a lot to talk about with these ones. These were some good movies. I'm glad we got to talk about them.
Yeah.
All right, the next episode is called Call Me Snake, and we're going to be talking some cool movies that involve some Snake Plissken, and then one that sort of involves a Snake Plissken, but more of a rewritten kind of a version of it.
Yeah, a Snake Plissken where they tried to avoid getting a lawsuit. But it didn't work.
Those movies are Escape from New York, Escape from LA, and Lockout.
Lockout.
I have never heard of Lockout. I didn't even know that movie ever even released. What the hell is it?
I don't think anyone ever saw it, but I saw the trailer for it once. And while I was watching, I was like, God, this is just a ripoff of Escape from New York. And then it turns out that, yes, that is the case, and we'll get, I think, more into that when we get into the episode. But, like, you know, for my money, it's Escape from New York and then two remakes, but we'll see.
I mean, at least we get to see Escape from New York again. All right, thank you so much for listening. Please make sure to subscribe and follow us on all the podcasts and social platforms at the Grindhouse Institute. And if you really want to give us a boost, check us out on Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. It helps us to get noticed. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll be back next week.
Ciao.
Well, it's time for this boogeyman to boogie. I'll be slaying you, boars and ghouls. Till next issue, try to stay scared.